Hello, this is Mark Shanton, welcoming you to Theatre Voice's latest monthly critical roundup, sponsored by Paul Gray Macmillan. I'm joined by our regular reviewing team of the Daily Telegraph's Charles Spencer, the International Herald Tribune's Matt Wolfe, Variety's David Benedict, and Kate Beth Bassett of The Independent on Sunday, to catch up on a series of revivals of plays by Eugene O'Neill, Joe Orton, Neil Simon and Robert Holman, while in the second part we will look at some new work. Let's begin this section by looking at the one epic play, Long Day's Journey Into Night, and a triptych of miniatures making noise quietly. Eugene O'Neill's most autobiographical play, Long Day's Journey Into Night, revolves around the unravelling of the family of the former travelling actor, tracking them across a single day and night, as the matriarch once again fights another losing battle to morphine addiction, and the younger son faces a diagnosis of consumption. Anthony Page directs a cast led by David Suchet and Laurie Metcalf as the parents, and Kyle Soller and Trevor White as their sons. David, it's a play we see quite a lot in London, in fact, indeed, on Broadway too. Is this revival, where does this latest revival fit into the scheme?
It doesn't fit well with me, I have to say. It's been trimmed, and I can see why. There's something monolithic about Eugene O'Neill, but I think that's sort of the point. He beats you into submission. This has been trimmed to make it more palatable, and it actually weirdly does the play a disservice, though it is, of course, fleeter and faster. You lose some of the magnificence of it. I also think that there's some weak casting. I think Laurie Metcalf is fantastic. She's a really, really wonderful stage actor. She has gravitas. She doesn't give the game away. You know, she's playing someone that is addicted to morphine, and she doesn't come on doing I'm addicted to morphine acting. In fact, she barely does it at any point. That makes the play more interesting to watch because it isn't a foregone conclusion. But I have a problem with David Suchet, who very patiently illustrates everything that is required, but you watch David Suchet sort of handing out bite-sized chunks of the performance. He's an ex-actor, and whether you play him as he used to be a brilliant Shakespeare actor, or whether you play him as he was just a barnstorming loud Shakespeare actor, you have to get the sense that he had that magnificence. And for me, he never does. I don't think Suchet's got rage in his repertoire. When he talks about Shakespeare, he gets a look behind his eyes, which is great, but it's the look of a man who collects first editions of Shakespeare rather than played them to towering effect.
Suchet has in fact become a sort of West End star, hasn't he, recently? He's done play after play in the last few years. Is he welcome to you, Matt?
Well, he certainly is committed to the American repertoire. It's very interesting. I mean, he gave a wonderful performance at the same theater a couple of years ago in All My Sons, and I gather that the part he really wants to do, and this is sort of a way station on the way to this next role, is Willy Loman, to which I think he's probably more suited than he is to this part. I agree completely with David that he doesn't quite have the charisma to Tyrone, although oddly, if you look at O'Neill's stage directions, O'Neill does say that he's 5'8", and actually the physical specimen that Suchet is, which is surprising because I'd always thought of James Tyrone being taller, a bit more elegant, a bit more Olivier-esque. But for me, the production doesn't take the title at face value. It's sort of a Short Day's Journey Into Night, which is counterintuitive, and rather like the Jessica Lange production a decade ago, which I thought was far and away the best thing she's ever done on stage. This is Laurie Metcalf's evening. She's absolutely amazing, prismatic, mercurial, moving, sort of bitterly funny, and also kind of scary.
It's interesting. Really, she was in the original cast of Detroit, which we're going to be doing in the second part, in Chicago.
She's an astonishing actress. She really is.
We had her at the National as well.
In All My Sons.
Yes. Charlie.
I loved it. I think the thing about cutting it is, I think you're wrong, actually, because that last act, which is mostly where the cuts are, I don't think there are many cuts anywhere else, is just quotes from other people's poems and things, and it's a very rough act, I think. And I think that 3 hours is about as much as you're going to... I think to do it in the West End is a really brave thing to do anyway. I mean, the title's enough to put anyone off. And I thought it was absolutely mesmerising. I like the fact that Suchet didn't sort of do the sort of grand, the grand old actor laddie. I agree Laurie Metcalf was sensational, but I also thought both the boys were very good. I thought it was as I've seen it about 3 times, I think it was certainly the best and the most lucid I've ever seen, and I thought it was absolutely bang on the money about how alcoholism and addiction works.
And quite brave to have it in the West End at all, Kate.
Yeah, I loved it as well, actually. I thought Laurie Metcalf was absolutely fantastic, and I agree with David that it was about the subtlety of the surfacing of her problem. And I like the fact that actually it is about a family who's seen it happen before, and so they see the tiny signs, and they are tiny, and I thought that was beautifully done. And I thought it was actually very good about caring. and how a carer can actually almost cause it by cosseting. So there's this very interesting situation around a mother, essentially, in that she's anxious about her son, and yet she's also very self-absorbed, and she's mentally fragile, and that fragility, it actually terrorises the family and is hugely powerful. And I think it's very interesting about the invalid in that sense and how a family deals with that. I thought Carl Soller was really good. David Suchet, I rather liked the fact that he was doing this sort of, at the start, doing sort of marital bliss, happy. It was almost like a check-off, you know, it was morning sunshine and everything seemed very nice. And then you just got this sense of a wary cosseting going on under the happy marital bliss. And then this horrible snappiness about his sons. And I think that's also true of families, that sometimes there can be the sort of alter ego in relationship to one child, or, you know, that, and I quite like the rage that surfaced there in almost like a sort of little terrier, you know, the sudden nasty sharp bark. So I really enjoyed it as well.
I think the thing that I which you mentioned, really, and it's just as someone who's had some experience of addiction and treatment centres and things, is it got brilliantly the way that the other characters circle round the mother, and there's a sort of technical word for that, and about walking on eggshells that is always used in treatment centres, and about how the person who is the addict creates this thing so that everyone else prowls around them this terribly defensive, you know, cosseting way, and how unhealthy all that is. And I thought it got the unhealthy, I mean, all four of the characters in this play are at different levels, are addicted, and they're all they're three alcoholics and one morphine addict, and morphine obviously is because the drinking is part of their culture, the Irish culture is more acceptable. But I thought it got the way that the dynamics of addiction and how people react to it absolutely brilliantly.
I was just very surprised at how unmoved I was. I admired the work. You know, there's a really, really solid set by Les Brotherston, which gives you a real sense of this home that's in antithesis to the trauma that's going on between people, and you know, this glow of autumnal lighting, and you go, oh, this is going to be lovely. And of course, those of us who've seen the play before know it's far from the case. But it just didn't take me on, to use that horrible expression, journey, but it's in the title. I just didn't go on a journey. I admired what people were doing, and for the first time ever I sat there and went, yes, I appreciate this, but I'm not cut up by it. And when you consider how magnificent Laurie Metcalfe was being, I find that very peculiar.
And also, following on from David, I think it's unbalanced, not just because for me it isn't long enough, and they're doing six shows a week of a production that's not much longer than One Man, Two Governors, as it is now, so I don't really see the point in that. But also, and this is, you know, the problem we all face as critics, with the two sons, I thought that Jamie Jr. was actually pretty dreadful, and I thought Carl Soler was okay. But, you know, when you've seen people like Peter Gallagher and Kevin Spacey tear into those roles for Jonathan Miller, making that extraordinary showdown between the two of them near the end just hair-raising, this didn't do it. So you really miss Mary in the second act. Yeah. You actively miss her until she comes down for that extraordinary threnody at the very end.
Robert Holman's Making Noise Quietly, by contrast, is smaller in scale and length, as three short plays chart a series of encounters between strangers, all of them touched by war, whether the Second World War in the first and third play, or the Falklands in the middle one. Originally premiered at the Bush in 1986 and subsequently revived by Oxford Stage Company in 1999 for a tour that came to the West End briefly, it's now directed by Peter Gill. Charlie, you've presumably seen the play before.
Yes, I think the Oxford Stage Company did it at the Whitehall about 10 years ago, or maybe more. It's an interesting Don Mar play to do. I mean, it's like a sort of rallying to a cause almost. There's a rather interesting essay by David Eldridge about how Robert Holman's a writer's writer, and I mean, he's been working for 35 years, and he's never had a hit, which must be pretty hard going, I think. I mean, the thing to keep struggling on like that and never really, you know, making any money and having a sort of succès fou. It's a very, I like it very much. It's a very quiet play. It's a gentle play about war often. It's got a lot of compassion, and I did find it quietly haunting. But it's never going to knock anyone out, I don't think. But it was beautifully played, and the first play in particular about two young I think both gay people, or one of them certainly perceived at the end to be one definitely gay and one sort of on the margins of not quite knowing, is particularly beautiful. The other two plays aren't quite as good, I don't think, but there is a lovely sort of wryness and delicacy of touch. And I think the thing about Holman is he hasn't had this big success, but he has got a sort of tone of voice that's all his own and is very special and cherishable, I think. And I think it was very brave for Josie to do it as her second show at the Normal. I don't know what sort of business it's done, I've no idea, but it was a brave choice and it's very well done. And just at the last Falklands play is a bit too Holocaust shadowed, I think, and a little glibly.
It is a sort of continuation, isn't it, from the regime of the Bush, since it was originally a Bush play. But also, it's met its perfect match with the director, Peter Gill, who writes the same sort of minor key plays.
I mean, I think Peter Gill has got the finest ear in British theatre. I mean, you just get faultless performances, and also in Peter Gill plays, Peter Gill productions, everybody is completely in the same play. They establish a rhythm. I mean, it's remarkable, as Charlie says, it's a very quiet play. Quiet is in the title. Press Night at the Donmar, I mean, it was so still, where in a play that's an inaction drama, you know, very little is happening except that there are these extraordinary little tiny shifts in power between people, and you could just feel the entire audience hanging upon this tension initially in the first play between the two young men. I agree with Charlie, the first play is by some measure the strongest. It's based on the artist Denton Welch. It's a sort of, it's one afternoon where two boys meet and discuss not very much, but rather a lot happens between them. It really charges up the air between them. The last play, which is in two scenes, doesn't quite work, although I think it's a very, very well directed and beautifully played production. Sarah Kestelman is really lovely as a German woman whose past is gradually revealed, who impacts upon the life of a young boy who's about 8 or 10, I think, who is being looked after by a squaddy. And it's there again, there's an absolutely peculiar tension that holds everybody. The middle play for me doesn't quite work because it's very clear what it's about. It's a play about a woman, someone from the Navy comes to tell her that her son has died in the Falklands. You sort of know that's going to happen, and her level of denial, there sort of isn't a metaphor in that play, and therefore it is what it is, it's nicely done, but it doesn't resonate in the way that the other two do. So even Peter Gill can't make it work as an entire evening, but moment to moment, I think it's pretty dazzling.
And very delicately played, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, weirdly, I mean, I guess I've been going to the theatre in London so many zillions of years that I saw the original production of The Bush, and in fact, I found my review of it from 1986 for City Limits, and I was more glowingly disposed towards it in 1986 than I am now, so I don't know what that says about me or it or whatever. I thought it began beautifully. I think the first one is an absolute jewel, sort of a perfect miniature. The second one, I think, is essentially filler and just very bald and frankly not very interesting. The third one is interesting because it's puzzling, but I don't really buy its co-option of the Holocaust. I think one thing that's happened to me as I've got older is I'm much more suspicious of and resistant to plays that invoke the Holocaust, just because why not?
And Peter Hall had that wonderful phrase about bumming a lift on the Holocaust to give your play a more...
And I never, he was citing Bent at the time, though, which was a dubious citation in relation to that claim.
But
however,
the Sarah Kestelman character, although I agree she plays it beautifully, she's taken in this really lippy squatty who's the stepfather of this guy, this young boy. And I didn't go to the press night, so I probably didn't see the same boy you did, I don't know. But whoever I saw had the loudest shriek I've ever heard in my life, so there was nothing quiet about his making noise. In fact, people in the audience were going like this. And it's got this rather unearned sentimental ending that apparently the Holocaust survivor teaches a life lesson to this young boy. And how? Why? And what are we supposed to glean from it? I didn't get it, but I admired the acting. The first one, I think, is just dazzling.
Well, we did see an extraordinary boy, didn't we, on the press night?
Yeah, the scream is absolutely... These repeated screams are...
It went right through you.
Yeah, and dramatically, very powerful. I agree about which plays are strongest. I think that's what we said. I think that Peter Gill's absolutely fantastic. kind of minimalistic staging. So this is this almost sort of green baize background. Mm. It's always modernist, abstract, but it serves as a forest or a meadow or whatever. And that kind of throws light, but quietly, right onto the acting and the absolutely fine detailing, and also the script. So, you know, it's very brave, actually, Peter Gill's directing, because he doesn't distract you from the core of the dramatic interaction. And it's beautifully done, and it's interesting that the York Realist has a touch, or his own play, the York Realist, has a touch of this first play, Making Noise Quietly, in that it's about a gay guy meeting a maybe gay, not but it hasn't been so far, guy. I think all the acting is brilliant, and the second play, though weak, I think John Hollingworth deserves a mention for just being very good at listening.
Which is what acting is all about.
Yes, I was watching him, and he's got swathes of just sitting there and minutely reacting to the mother who he sold, whose son's died. So I was strangely absorbed, and I also think I thought Ben Batt was very promising in the third play as a young squaddy, and I think Matthew Tennyson was sort of scintillatingly complex as the gay guy in the first play, sort of affable and friendly and boho and showy off, and then just this little edge of spite or malignity that was really brilliant. I'd like to see what his range is.
And wonderfully contrasted, I agree with you, Kate, wonderfully contrasted Jordan Dawes in the first play, who I thought gave off such a lovely sense of sweetness and openness, and what is this world that you're presenting to me? They were a lovely set of
this is his first job. I mean,
he's terrific. Yeah.
Jordan Dawes, I thought, was extraordinary. Again,
it's a much less showy part,
but again, to be able to just sit there on a stage where we believe it's a summer's afternoon in a hot field, and just sit and listen and hold attention rather than just being, you know, given that Matthew Tennyson is opposite him, who's got a much showier part, who's very effete and playing around with a bicycle and is running the scene, to just sit there but actually to be able to hold the focus without pulling it is really remarkable.
And actually the play, when Matt said about him being open, that play is actually rather interesting about who's conservative and who isn't, and it flips rather sharply at the end, and that, you know, it's kind of interesting about who thinks they're boho and liberal.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I find the ending of it terribly moving. Mm-hmm. Actually,
too. Yes.
It's beautifully done.
From two very serious plays to two classic comedies, both of them with a serious undercurrent, and first produced 3 years apart on opposite sides of the Atlantic. Joe Orton's What the Butler Saw was first produced in the West End in 1969, 2 years after the author's death at the age of 34, while The Sunshine Boys was first premiered on Broadway in 1972. Looking at What the Butler Saw first, farces are suddenly all the rage in the West End, from the transfer of Noises Off from the Old Vic to the Novello, and One Man, Two Guns from the National to the Haymarket. What the Butler Saw appropriates the form of farce to provide an exercise in comic subversion set in a psychiatric clinic, where the doctor running it, played by Tim McInerney, may very well be more crazy than his patients. Sean Foley directs a cast that also includes Samantha Bond and Omid Djalili at the Vaudeville Theatre. Kate, is all this farce too much of a good thing?
Possibly. I'm not absolutely wild about farce myself. I enjoyed this slightly more than I thought I was going to, because I sometimes find Orton dated and a bit of a bore, and I thought that I thought Sean Foley's production was fluid and fast and well timed in that classic kind of mechanism of people rushing in and out. I found it got quite shouty for me at one point, and I do think the play has dated in some ways. It hasn't got the outre frisson that obviously it had in the 60s, and I think the end is a sort of the Churchill's penis features in a small marble penis is brought out. And frankly, that seems sort of puerile to me now, whereas I guess it would have been shocking. But I essentially thought the older actors were doing really good jobs. I thought the two younger actors were disappointing. And I thought Omid Djalili was actually rather good. I thought it wasn't a comedian turned actor's performance. I thought he was actually completely getting the writing and not absolutely hamming up the cod melodrama. So, it's not really a play for me, but I thought it was a fairly good West End production of it.
Charlie, you grimaced, as Kate said, which actually was good.
I think it's a masterpiece, this play, and I think I thought it was absolutely wrecked in the performance. I thought it was so crude. I thought the farce was unfunny. Everything was overstated. Shouting, not just at one moment, I thought they were shouting all the way through it. I thought Omid Jalili was just totally unfunny and just sort of roared all the time. I absolutely loathed it. I agree, it's an extraordinarily hard play to bring off because it has got a genuinely Wildean wit about it. Almost every line has got a sting in its tail or a sudden kick to it. It's wonderfully written. It's his best script, but terribly hard to do, and combined with this rather ingenious farce. And it needs to be done with real precision, and I just thought it was being done as though it was an end of the pier show, and I just absolutely loathed it.
I always feel when I see this play, because the ending revolves around a rather crucial prop, I always think, what branch of Clone Zone did the prop master rush off to get what dimension phallus that said actor can wave at an audience that is nowadays probably not going to be shocked? They're probably just going to be bemused and go, oh, I saw that at home. But so that aspect of it perhaps hasn't held up, forgive the image, perhaps as well as the language, which holds up beautifully. But this production could be called Making Noise Noisily, because it just is so strident. And actually, it's interesting, Kate, you say that you like the older actors and not so much the younger ones, because actually I really like the younger ones a lot.
Did you?
And I thought the older ones were awful. Tim McInerney was... practically, his neck muscles were practically splitting open like something out of Aliens 3, because he was in such a state of advanced overdrive. But it doesn't seem to me to trust the material.
No.
Finally in this section, the Sunshine Boys, which is playing across the street from what the Butler saw at the Savoy Theatre, is an old-fashioned star vehicle for Danny DeVito and Richard Griffiths to put the box office shine into a 40-year-old Broadway comedy about a double act who worked together for 43 years and are now being reunited for a TV special. I don't remember if this has ever been on in the West End, but I've certainly never seen it. It's well known for the film version, isn't it, Matt?
Yes, and I have a very sentimental connection with an attachment to the film version, because my late father, who ran a paint and wallpaper manufacturing business, had a calendar that went with his business, and in the film, his calendar is hanging on the wall of Walter Matthau's apartment. So when the film came out in the mid-70s, the Wolf family, such as we were, trotted along to see the film and were, of course, charmed both by Walter Matthau and George Burns, and by the art decoration and set decoration that was clever enough to put Dad's poster on the wall, where you know, it still is in the film, obviously. Well, as Kate knows, because we talked about it, I was rather dreading this, but actually, I was kind of pleasantly surprised in that it's not really about what you think it's going to be about, which is sort of the two of them bantering away, I think. I think it's actually about fear of aging and mortality and what you do in your twilight years. And in a funny way, this sounds totally heretical, I was more moved by this than by Long Day's Journey and Tonight. I just thought there was something about the two of them chattering into the void as the curtain fell at the end that was rather lovely. I do find, it's hard to say this, but I do find it quite difficult to watch Richard Griffiths, because his discomfort is so readily communicated to an audience. On the other hand, I thought Danny DeVito was pretty amazing, and I've never seen him on stage because he hasn't been on stage for 40-odd years.
Indeed. Charlie?
I loved it. I just thought it was a really sort of golden evening, actually. DeVito is just terrific. I mean, he's so alive all the time, so sort of spontaneously funny and sort of grumpy and growly, and I liked the casting. Richard Griffiths, I think I said in my review, it looks as though Richard Griffiths could eat two DeVitos for breakfast and have room for corned beef hash on the side. What I like about it is it's a very self-effacing performance from Griffiths. I mean, he's a huge man, and yet there's a kind of sort of delicacy, and he's sort of letting the light shine on DeVito, who is the main character. I just thought, I mean, I've said terrible things about Neil Simon over the years, because I do think that at heart he's a sentimentalist, but there's something about this play that was genuinely touching and moving, I felt, and DeVito just remembering him, he sort of vibrates with lust at one point in the sketch, and I just think he's a terrific sort of full-on performer, and loved it, and very endearing.
It's a bit of a slow burn, I thought. It took a while to get going.
Charlie and I are just going to flip side opinions of these two comedies. I couldn't be doing this at all. I thought it was really slow. I was just like, can we get on with the sketch that you're meant to be recreating? Because I'm bored now. And I've got the gist of you setting up the gags already, way ahead of time, and here they come. I thought it was like a kind of poor variation on the Odd Couple. I agree that actually it is about getting old and what you do with your time, and actually that is under it. For me, strangely, I find Danny DeVito's performance very showy in a rather Broadway stage way, in that sense that I always feel as if the actor is self-consciously showing the audience what they're doing and wanting to be loved. And actually I think Danny DeVito's character is actually quite nasty, and you have to sort of balance that with the comedy, but I thought it was a love me performance. And so, you know, he'd pull a pouting face, and then he'd do his shuffle across stage, and it was all very self-conscious. And actually I thought Thea Sharrock was uninspired in her directing, that she there would be a direction of, why don't you go across the room and sit on that stool now, because this is a really inactive play. So I didn't have much time for it, actually.
And the set feels inaccurate as well. It's not quite right that they're crowded into this little room.
I mean, I think the set was the least of my problems. I'm fairly close to Kate on this. I just think that it's the first act is really, really sloppily written. The best thing in the show, without a doubt, is the routine, which pulls off the trick of these are two guys that had an act together for 43 years. There's a history of comedy being done on television, and obviously, because it's a history of comedy, they have to have these two guys, which is why they get together to do the sketch one more time. And you watch the sketch, and it is as if you've known it all your life, although it is an entirely manufactured sketch. And it's antique and sexist and ridiculous, and it doesn't matter. You believe it. And you sort of believe in the way that they're playing it, but that was the only thing I did believe about the show. I mean, the construction of the minor characters is execrable. I give 1,000 points to the nurse, played by Johnny Fiore, who actually turns the nurse into a human being. Everybody else comes on and plays their role, which is, hello, I'm the nephew, or in the poor nephew's case, hello, I'm the nephew, underwritten, and the agent, underwritten, two for the price of one. He doesn't know what to do, so he plays everything right out front. Danny DeVito plays everything right out front. They don't really talk to one another. Richard Griffiths is listening and plays with other people. Everybody's in a completely different show because it hasn't been properly directed, which is why the underwritten first act is so cumbersome. The second act, as I said, gets better, and I think you're right, Matt, that this is a play about aging, and some of that comes through, but certainly at the performance that I saw, it didn't feel as if these are two guys that have not spoken for 12 years, but used to have an act and used to be together. They look like they'd barely met. Their styles are so different. I didn't believe they were a team until they were on stage. You have to get a sense, particularly for the end to land, that actually, underneath all their bickering, there is a vestigial love. And the performance I saw looked like
they'd never got it. Oh, I thought you absolutely got that at the end. I think for me, I mean, you know, you talk about the Odd Couple. This is the Old Couple. It's the Odd Couple turned old. Yeah. So it is a de facto sequel in everything except actual name. And for me, the loveliest bit, I mean, of course, you're right, David, about the routine has to land. But I actually love the very end, because you know it's going to be sentimental. But then you think, well, how? Because everything is mitigating against that. And Neil Simon finds quite a clever way to land the two of them, without giving it away, in a place where it is sentimental. And then the very last image is them chattering away at each other as the curtain falls, a little bit like Beatrice and Benedict, an odd connection. But I also think, you know, these are two such different performers. I don't know who I would cast opposite Danny DeVito, but it wouldn't be Richard Griffiths.
No, I liked it almost as much as anything I've seen for months, actually. It really worked for me.
On that note, thank you, David, Matt, Charlie and Kate.